Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, January 6, 2014. Gee, it's the first show of the year, Vicki, so Happy New Year to everybody.
Yeah, Happy 2014.
Right. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include what new breakthrough in medicine can solve the problem of hospital-acquired infections.
And what common food feeds colds and flus.
And what's another common food that predisposes us to cancer?
And is there a new drug that can prevent Alzheimer's disease?
And when should blood pressure not be treated?
With the pandemic of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, we're in sore need of a different way to prevent and treat infections and using antibiotics, which are creating the resistant bacteria in the first place. Now, 2 billion people carry staph. That's Staphylococcus aureus. And out of those, 53 million have MRSA, that's the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, with $4 billion per year spent on hospitalizations with the MRSA. So, tell us about the exciting new studies on blue light phototherapy and your experience with
it. Right. Now, this has really been exciting for me. And I want to point out that there are about 100,000 deaths a year from superbugs. So this is not a small thing, and about 20,000 deaths from just MRSA alone. The other causes are things like C. difficile, Klebsiella, E. coli, and some other unusual microbes. But the light, you know, light therapy is something that we don't think about much in the mainstream of medicine because we're really into a biochemical paradigm. What we're thinking of is cellular biochemistry and that runs everything. We don't look at the biophysics of what's happening, which is really a lot deeper as far as a cause is concerned of how our bodies operate and what can be done to restore it back to normal health.
Usually when we think of the light, I think we think of using it for pain.
Well, you and I do, but most doctors don't. I mean, we're looking at infrared light that's near infrared light. It's at about 760 to 780 nanometers as a powerful tool that does a lot of things in clinical practice that I've been doing for almost 15 years now.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it, that other doctors aren't doing it? It should be a part of every doctor's practice and a part of every hospital.
Well, you know, the doctors that I've shown what I do come in, and they literally get blown away. And if they happen to have a problem with pain, very often that's what blows them away because we can fix it. And it's right on the spot. It's not like something you have to do physical therapy for 3 to 6 months or do some surgical procedure or do an injection of something to make pain go away. It works right now in most people who come to see me.
So what about using it for these MRSA infections or antibiotic-resistant infections?
That's a different kind of light than infrared. It's actually a blue light. And the blue light is amazing because it actually kills the MRSA bugs, and it kills a lot of the other bugs like Pseudomonas and that are present in people who have these severe infections in the hospital.
But don't you have one of these blue lights that's combined with one of your photon stimulators?
You know, the fellow that I work with that makes these lights that once owned a big company and now really just does research, and we collaborate to do research every day almost. We stay in touch with each other. He made one with blue, and he said, why don't you try this? It has both blue and infrared, and let's just see if it does anything different. He said it probably isn't going to do a lot for some things because it doesn't penetrate very deep. You know, the infrared light penetrates about 10 inches. That's 23 centimeters. So it really gets good penetration. The blue light, he says, only going to go in a little bit, just maybe a few millimeters. And I said, well, if it's not going to penetrate, then what should we use it for? And he said, well, how about doing it for ulcers? You know, people who have skin conditions. And he really didn't know.
Like bed sores.
Yeah, bed sores or people who have diabetic wounds or people who have traumatic ulcers. Or
rashes, I guess.
Well, sometimes for rashes too, although I haven't used it a lot for that with much success. So when I tried the blue light with the infrared, I found that we got a better response. And I really didn't know why, because I don't know the biophysics, or didn't at that time, of what blue light does. But as it turns out, the blue light kills microbes. It kills things like the methicillin-resistant staph.
Well, that's pretty exciting.
Which is a big deal. And it's not like you have to use a ton of light, and it's not like it has to be a very powerful light. It's a light with reasonable power that's safe to use that does some amazing things. I had a patient who had a severe staph infection on his foot, but I didn't know it was a staph infection at the time. And my infrared light with the blue light attached to it was back being repaired at my friend's place because there was a problem with it. And so all I had were the other infrared lights that I was using, and it was seemed to help, but it wasn't doing anything real fast, but it was helping. So when the blue light came back, I tried it, and within 2 days, the bulk of that infection cleared, and I was going, wow, it must be something about the blue light.
Well,
and then these articles came out. Okay, just in recently, it was in November of 2013, that looked at some of these effects of blue light and talked about some of the mechanisms of action. And here we are.
Well, I remember another time going to your office and you were treating somebody that had gangrene in his toe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that with a blue light that time? Because I know that have to have an amputation after he was treated.
Well, this was a fellow who had frostbite. He was at the top of Mount Everest, lost his oxygen supply, and had gangrene.
Well, that was another case. There was another one that had gangrene from diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could be.
An older man.
Uh-huh. Well, okay. I don't think it was infection that was causing his problem particularly. I think it was loss of blood supply.
Oh.
And so what we did is we used the regular infrared light, and over a period of about 3 months, we didn't amputate anything. And he lost the tips of three toes, didn't lose anything.
Oh, that was the frostbite,
with
man.
With frostbite.
Okay.
And the person who had diabetes, who had had an amputation before, and also had some ulcers in two toes and osteomyelitis, responded very well to the infrared light without the blue because his infection was deepened into bone. And over a period of about 3 months, that too healed fully, and he never did have to have an amputation.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, anyway, let's talk about some of the sources of the MRSA and some of the other antibiotic-resistant infections. Like, for example, livestock. You know, we're always hearing people say that it's not a good thing to eat meat that's come from a
from the stock regular meat market.
Feedlot beef. Feedlot, that's it. From the feedlot beef, because they give them antibiotics rather than cleaning up the area so that they don't get these infections.
So it winds up killing those microbes that are susceptible to the antibiotic, and it leaves all the ones that are resistant to it to overgrow.
And
so we wound up with
that.
MRSA and Pseudomonas and Enterococcus. I mean, all kinds of infections, even some E. coli, that sometimes are transmitted to people when we get the meat. And, of course, they get very sick from it.
And sometimes people get the MRSA infections from being hospitalized. So they get it
in the hospital. But the most common cause of MRSA now is from the community. It's called community acquired.
That's pretty scary. Well, you notice when you go to, they said 92% of hospitalizations are from this community acquired.
Well, yeah, as many as that. That's right.
So when you go to a hospital, there are a lot of dispensers for using the antibacterial hand wipes and hand soaps.
There are a lot of things in the hospital that just don't work. Because
what's crazy about that, everybody thinks, oh, that's what I want to use, an antibacterial hand wash. Well, that hand wipe or wash, that's the same idea as taking an antibiotic, because then you develop the resistant bugs.
Well, you may. That's a concern. I think the concern in the hospital is kill all the bugs that you can, including the methicillin-resistant staph, by washing your hands or wearing gloves. And it does help to some extent. But the staph doesn't follow the rules much. We know because we've reported already in the past situations where they post cameras that are hidden. And they watch to see if the doctors and nurses and other staff, hospital staff, are actually using the hand wash and washing their hands when they come in and leave. And most of the time, they don't.
Really? Because when I've been there, it seems to me like they do. But
Well, that's maybe because you're there and they know you're a nurse, or I'm there and they know I'm a doctor. And, of course, one of the first things we look for is that.
Well, that's true. That's true, too.
So, but,
you know, in the past, we've talked about other things that kill bacteria, like the copper surfaces.
There's something that's really an oversight by hospitals. You know, within an hour and a half, you kill 97% of all the microbes that are in a hospital and can cut back on infections in ICU by at least 50%.
Yeah, so if they could use copper, like on the switches at the elevators and in the bathrooms, on
the
doors.
Yeah,
and
the trays, anything.
In the hospitals, the patient's bedside tray, all those things. The more copper, the better anyway.
Exactly.
And then I was thinking about this blue light, if there's a way that they could install that. You know, sometimes now, when I've gone into public restrooms, they have hand dryers that you put your hand inside and it just blows your hand dry.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be good if they could do that with a blue light and then it would kill all the germs?
Well, you know, back when I was in training at Duke University Medical Center in 1965, oh my gosh, a long time ago, they used UV lights, which also kill microbes in all the surgical suites because infection was a big issue at that time. And that's one way to do it as well. So in the hospital, there could be many, many places where this blue light could be because it's a safe thing to do insofar as we know, and it's been around a long time. It's really part of what sunlight is about. And it's a good way to sterilize things that are in a hospital.
So let's talk about some of the ways that, well, some of the things that are being done now, to help this situation.
With MRSA?
Besides giving antibiotics to create more
of it. Yeah. Well, we tend to do things like hyperbaric oxygen, which can help some, but it's not any big panacea, and it has to be done a long time, and it's reasonably expensive and inconvenient to do.
Can you briefly define what hyperbaric oxygen is?
Yeah, it just means that instead of breathing 21% oxygen, which is what room air has, it's 100% oxygen, and it's under the pressure of 2 or 3 atmospheres. So there's a lot of oxygen there. That'll supersaturate blood with oxygen, bring more blood to the tissues, and bring more nutrients as well, and more metabolism, more ATP, which is the energy currency of the body, to be able to fight these infections.
So how's that working?
Not that well. It's okay, and it's used a lot because what other things do we have to use when we've got an infection that doesn't respond to antibiotics? Then there's some older therapies that were, one was called photooxidation, where actually in the 1940s, before the antibiotic era, you could shine ultraviolet light on blood and put it back in the body. So you'd put a needle in a vein, extract blood, run it through a coil, shine ultraviolet light on it, run it right back into the body, and use 150 or 200 cc's. And some rather dramatic things happened. You could see more oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood. You could see less in the way of acidosis. You would see the infections clearing from peritonitis and other kinds of very serious infections. And only a few treatments over the course of a week or 10 days, and most of the people that got that got better. But when antibiotics came out, that was discarded because it was kind of a clumsy system to use.
So why don't they bring it back?
Well, because nobody cares enough about to look at that. There's not much money in it. It's shocking to me that there are people dying in the ICU and we're not doing some things that are like that that have some potential. And these are articles that were published in the mainstream medical journals like the journal called Surgery. They had 250 consecutive cases that they published of people with peritonitis from ruptured appendixes and gallbladders and things like that, and people in the ICU or in the main floor with severe infections who got well most of the time. So it's something we should be looking
back
at.
Did that help with polio, or am I thinking of something
polio
else?
Was IV vitamin C.
It was IV
a guy
vitamin
named
C.
Klenner published some stuff in a journal in the late 1940s. Showed that those people that he treated with IV vitamin C didn't come down with paralytic polio. It was like a magic thing. And at that same time, the epidemic was dying down and it got lost.
You think IV vitamin C could help these people then?
Well, I think it would be something I would try. Yeah, there would be no reason not to try it because it's safe and it might do things that would add to it as well.
Well, I know another thing that they are using is some photodynamic therapy But how does that work, and why isn't that so?
So let's define what that is. That's using usually infrared light to activate something like a chemical that, when the light hits it, turns it into a toxic substance. It makes free radicals that will kill anything that it's near.
So they're not injecting a chemical.
Well, they do in dentistry. Very often they'll inject methylene blue into the root canal or into the root of the tooth if it's infected, or if they're having other kinds of problems with gums, and then shine this blue light on it, and it causes a reaction that actually helps a lot of these infected root canals, and people who have had tooth implants can actually make those infections go away. And that's in practice today.
Don't they add oxygen with that too?
They don't have to add oxygen to that, but you could. It would be one more thing, but again, hyperbaric oxygen is a big deal. It's not so convenient to use, and it gets expensive.
Is this the same as hyperbaric oxygen?
No, it's different. What we're doing
that's what I thought.
No, we're injecting methylene blue, into the tissues. And then we're shining a light on it that's actually a red light. It's not infrared. It's in the red frequency of visible light. And that causes the methylene blue to cause a reaction that produces free radicals that kills the microbes that are there. So that's what photodynamic therapy can be used for, treating cancers as well.
And also, aren't there antibacterial clays?
There's some clays that do some rather remarkable things. If you can put into clay a bunch of different kinds of metals, like cobalt or zinc, copper, iron, or nickel.
The copper.
Copper again. What happens is it will do a lot on superficial infections, like if you have a MRSA infection on the skin or a wound infection. This is a great way to try and treat that, because it causes the same kind of change by producing free radicals that will kill most of those microbes. MRSA, for example, if you use a clay impregnated with copper, cobalt, or zinc, you'll see some changes that can be very effective at clearing up those infections.
So, well, it sounds to me like this blue light is a pretty good way to go, because it stands on its own and you don't need that photosensitizer.
Right.
Sorry.
You're thinking type about of, plant
type
metabolism.
Of, type of chemical, so you don't have to do that.
It's simple. All you do is shine the light on the skin, where the infection is, like I did with my patient when we started this out at the beginning, and we were talking about, he had a staph infection. We used the infrared light. It helped some, and it was getting well, but not as fast as I would like to see. And then all of a sudden, when the blue light came back from being fixed, and we put that on the skin, within about 2 days, it cleared up. So the blue light does some amazing things to kill methicillin-resistant staph. And it does it by, again, creating free radicals in the tissue that will kill the microbes. So it's a great way to approach it, and I think it's a treatment that should be used today in the hospitals. We've got the solutions today that we need to solve these problems that look like they're far away, because it's a whole different kind of thinking. We're into the biophysics of what's happening.
You know, if so many people are carrying staph, and a lot of people are carrying methicillin-resistant staph, but a lot of people aren't being infected by it. They just are carriers of it.
Well, they would be infected by it, meaning they carry it, If you've got it in your tissues, you can carry a certain amount of it without any problem. But keep in mind that methicillin-resistant staph makes an endotoxin, something that's poisonous to our body. If we only have a few methicillin-resistant staph, who cares? It's not going to be a big deal, because our body can handle it. But if that starts growing like crazy, and you've got now a whole bunch of methicillin-resistant staph, that volume of endotoxin is enough to do you in sometimes. So that's what we're looking at
here. And then
here,
particularly if you've had surgery.
Exactly.
And you have an open wound.
Okay, so you've got a wound, a surgical wound. It's been closed. An infection sets in on the surface and then goes deeper. And you get sick because your immunity is low. You've had a surgical procedure. The methicillin-resistant staph can take hold.
And kill you.
Here we are. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on, does iceberg lettuce have nutritional value? I've always wondered about that. And when we come back, we're talking about what common food feeds colds and flus.
Iceberg lettuce is preferred over most other types of lettuce because it's crispy. And while most of the darker greens are richer in nutrients, iceberg lettuce is still a pretty healthy choice. Now, we know that it doesn't really have any fat in it, and it's a good source of iron and vitamin B6 and K and A and C, and it's high in dietary fiber, and it has even traces of omega fatty acids, which is important for our health. But folate's another benefit that iceberg lettuce provides, which helps fight heart disease. Now, iceberg lettuce might be a little lower in the C and the A and the iron and the potassium and the calcium than the darker greens, but it's not as if iceberg lettuce has no nutritional value at all, and it's had a reputation of being low in nutrition. But since it has less and fewer nutrients than the leaf lettuce, maybe you could try switching to leaf lettuce and mix in a little bit of the iceberg with it, because it's a good way to maintain that moist crispiness without sacrificing the nutrition. And the iceberg seems to be at the bottom of the list for nutritional value, but it still has a lot of these healthy benefits, so it shouldn't really be ruled out completely. And leaf lettuce tends to be a little bit bitter, and so due to the high water content of the iceberg lettuce, mixing the two helps to eliminate that bitterness of the leaf lettuce, and you're still maintaining important nutrients and giving it that crunchy texture. So I was thinking it might be a good idea when you make a sandwich to put the iceberg lettuce in the sandwich, but maybe add a little of the other greens with it.
Well, maybe. I think every food has its advantage, and who knows what it is in iceberg lettuce that makes it so special. And we may not know that.
I like it.
I do, too. Well, that's a good thing. If it tastes good, that's
a
start.
It's better than a lot of other things you could be eating.
It sure is.
Okay, so, it's no secret that sweets and soft drinks aren't healthy and that sugar inhibits the action of our white blood cells to fight viral infections, including influenza. And now that we have new evidence showing that sugar determines a virus's ability to make us sick, we know how important it is to avoid sugar, especially if we are looking for ways to avoid the flu, because this new study shows that sugar invites the influenza to infect us. But, avoiding sugar isn't an easy task.
No, but if you want to be well, it's
and
probably not
getting,
something when you're sick.
And if you're getting sick, you might want to choose the iceberg lettuce over the
over
the chocolate.
Yeah, maybe so. We've known by observation for years that when you take in a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of sweets, a lot of high fructose corn syrup or sugar, that getting rid of a cold is a little bit tougher, and maybe it even brings colds on. And we were searching for mechanisms to explain why is it like that. And the conclusion I came to years ago was based on a couple of papers that showed that if you consume sugar and then you look at white blood cell activity, that it was suppressed. And the white blood cells are what fight the infection that you get when you're sick. So that was something that showed us that if you had just as much as one soft drink every 8 hours, that would be enough to really slow down the activity of your immune system through the activity of white blood cells, and you would have fewer defense mechanisms. And maybe we thought that was enough to explain it.
But, the other thing I was thinking of is that sweets are kind of what we call a comfort food. Mm-hmm. And when people are getting sick many times, that's kind of what they want. They don't feel so good, and they're looking for something to comfort themselves. And it's really just the opposite, because that's going to tip them over the iceberg.
Well, now that we've found out this other evidence, this other information here, it explains a little bit more why sugar is such a bad thing. So people who were doing this study that was published in the journal Virology in September of 2013, were out of the University of North Carolina, presented their study at the American Society for Cell Biology's annual meeting in December 15th. And what they said is that you could reduce a virus's sugar supply and you'd weaken the ability of the microbe to infect host cells. That means the ability to infect the cells of your throat, okay, of your pharynx or lungs or wherever this is going to go. And they also showed in tissue cultures that they could lower the amount of sugar that was present, and there would be less ability of the virus to be able to replicate and to go into the tissues of the cell where it would infect us. And if the sugar levels were high, they got the reverse thing. So they got the idea of, in this experiment, which was not done inside the body, it was done in an in vitro setting, which means outside the body as opposed to in vivo, which is in the body, they went ahead and blocked the metabolism of sugar inside the cell and showed that that would slow down the ability of the virus to be able to replicate and get into the cytoplasm of the cell, which is where it infects and causes cell injury. So this was a new mechanism that really kind of told us the story of what's happening there.
And you know, too, if you've listened to us before, you know that we're not advocates of flu vaccines.
But, oh, that's for sure.
But in living a healthy lifestyle, which includes a healthy diet, which means low in sugar. And now a few years ago, Dr. Andrew Weil, he got in big trouble with the FDA because he recommended a dietary supplement, astragalus, for the flu.
Well, that was at a time when everybody was trying to promote the vaccine because of the supposed swine flu epidemic in 2009, which turned out to be no more than hype and BS. I mean, that was one of the most unbelievable fabricated pandemics of all time. I mean, it turned out to be no more than a less than average flu year. And then to promote the vaccine, which didn't have any safety record or any real evidence that it works, to me was a travesty.
So now with this information now about the sugar, mm-hmm. I wonder how Big Pharma is going to react to this, because they're probably wanting to create a drug to decrease the amount of glucose.
Oh, you know that'll be the next thing that happens, but that's going to be very challenging because your body needs glucose. It needs a certain amount. And if you lower it below a certain amount, you wind up having seizures.
Well, it's pretty easy to get it without even trying, because sugar and starches and things like that are added to so much of our food that we're many times not even aware of. I mean, they put sugar in soup, you know?
Well, I think the take-home message in this particular story is that sugar is not a good thing to consume in very high amounts. I would go real, particularly in the flu season, cut back on the thing that you know is going to put you at a higher risk for developing a lot of things, not just a problem with colds. I mean, you're talking about all the problems we see with high fructose corn syrup, which leads to cirrhosis in its stages, in fatty liver to cirrhosis, to problems with diabetes and heart attacks and strokes and cancers of different kinds. I mean, it's not something to mess with. So your lifestyle and how you treat yourself has a huge effect on what's going to happen to you in terms of your quality of life and what kinds of illnesses you're going to be getting.
Well, since we're just starting the new year,
yeah,
might be a good resolution to try to at least avoid the refined sugar.
Well, I'd stay away from all kinds of sweets if, you know, during this, in general.
Because the holidays, it's so easy to eat sweets because everybody gives them to you. They're around. It's like the holidays and everybody's doing that. Well, now that's behind us. And if you haven't already eaten it and finished it off.
Yeah, right, like we have. Right. This is a dangerous time of year for us.
Yeah, so.
So for sure, I mean, lifestyle is definitely the most important way to fight getting sick in the first place. Your diet, exercise, stress, sleep, what you weigh, what you're exposed to in the environment, in the way of environmental toxins, and how happy you are. Do you have that inner smile? If you do all those things right, you're probably not going to get sick. You're not going to have to necessarily have those viruses or other kinds of infections take hold in your body, because you'll have immune defenses that are strong.
Well, it's a lot better to cut back on your sweets than it is to go get a flu vaccine.
Oh, well, listen, if you want to learn more about the flu vaccine, which is an outrageous scam, just go to the website, drsaputo.com, and in the search box put the infection deception. And there what you'll get is an article that I wrote that's about 15 pages long, that's referenced, that was published in the journal The Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. So you'll see what I'm talking about. All right, it's time for a station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and we'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio. And we'll be talking about what common food predisposes us to cancer. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
You know, we already know that too much sugar is unhealthy, and it can predispose us to the flu, and it can cause inflammation. And it's also not new that cancer cells love sugar.
Yeah, they depend on it.
So if you have cancer, it's best to avoid sugar, especially refined sugar. Now, a new study from the Berkeley Lab of Life Sciences Division shows that the way sugars metabolize defines whether or not cancer is present. And a cancer cell can absorb glucose 400 times more than non-cancerous cells. Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? You know, we're always looking for differences between normal cells and cancer cells, and this is certainly one that tips us to what's happening.
Boy, if that isn't motivating to stay away from sugar, I don't know what is.
Well, for sure, but it may be that it's something that happens to cancer cells. You know, the work that was done by Nobel Prize winner Otto Warburg back in 1921, or in that range, basically was talking about how all normal cells have an absolute requirement for oxygen. But cancer cells can live without it. In fact, it's the rule, without any exceptions. You deprive a cell of 35% of its oxygen for 48 hours, and it may become cancerous, according to his research. And it's clear that the root cause of cancer is an oxygen deficiency, which creates an acidic state in the human body. So Dr. Warburg discovered this and realized that cancer cells are anaerobic, meaning they don't burn oxygen. And this work that Mina Bissell found from for Berkeley Lab for Life Sciences that she's been talking about is amazingly interesting work, because she's showing that a lot of what regulates this is not the DNA of a cell at all. It's not the nucleus of the cell. It's the extracellular fluid that's around the cell that determines what kind of metabolism a cell is going to have and whether or not it's going to be cancerous.
So like if there's sugar in the fluid?
Well, no, not so much the sugar in the fluid. It's just that cancer cells depend on sugar. So it has a mechanism of absorbing it that's 400 times better than cells that are not cancerous, because it can't. Its mitochondria don't work well. So if the mitochondria doesn't work well and you can't do aerobic metabolism, which is what the mitochondria does, you're depending on sugar to make in an anaerobic way, meaning without oxygen, to maintain its life. And that's what happens in cancer.
So if a person has cancer, it's better to avoid sugar than to take chemo and radiation?
Well, I wouldn't say that necessarily, but that's good thinking. I mean, if it would work that you'd go on just a low-sugar diet, that would make sense. But once the cancer is out of the barn, then you can't just deprive yourself of sugar, because if you become hypoglycemic, what happens? You can have seizures. You can have lots of things go wrong that are really terrible. So you can't live without having a certain glucose level in your system. But the interesting finding that Mina Bissell came up with that I thought that was fantastic is she could show that it's the fluid surrounding the cell that communicates with the DNA in the nucleus of the cell that determines whether or not a cell is going to be normal or not normal. So you could take the extracellular fluid around a cancer cell and concentrate it, and then put it into a rat, and it will develop cancer because of the information and the biochemistry of what's in that extracellular fluid.
Which is kind of like our bodies being in an environment of toxins.
Well, it's another way to look at it. That's a good analogy. And you could look at it the other way around, too, so that if you have somebody who has a cancer and you put a normal extracellular fluid around it, it can convert it from a cancer to a non-cancer, tissue that looks normal.
So, too, like if you block the glucose in the cell, then it will act normal, and then it doesn't hurt the normal cells.
Well, that's right. And it's something that's new that we didn't know that is fantastic. She also did some studies with a physicist that looked at the movement of cells in three dimensions. And most people don't know this, but cells actually rotate. They're not just sitting there doing nothing. They actually have a spin to them. And when you take
kind of like the planet.
Like the planet, exactly. And so when you have a cell that's spinning normally, it looks one way. But if you look at a cancer cell, it has movement that's chaotic, that doesn't have a natural spin to it like a normal cell does. And when you expose these cancer cells to normal extracellular fluid, they go back to normal again. So there's a lot that we have to learn about cancer that's new, that goes beyond what Otto Warburg was talking about, even though he's looked at really as maybe the father of understanding what cancer cells are like and what makes them turn out to be cancer cells to start with.
Well, do these findings help explain why hyperglycemia in obesity and metabolic diseases like diabetes can raise the risk of breast and other cancers?
They might. If you offer more sugar to a cancer cell, not only does it have 400 times more ability to bring cancer or to bring glucose into a cancer cell than a normal cell does, but now you're bathing it in an environment that has a very high sugar level, you're obviously just supporting what the cancer cell needs, which is sugar to maintain its metabolism.
Okay, so it's better to not eat much sugar.
You want to avoid sugar, but you
and
can't.
If you have
you
cancer,
can't cure. Well, I mean, if there was no sugar in your bloodstream, yeah, you'd kill the cancer, but you'd kill yourself too.
Okay, but if you have cancer, mm-hmm. it's probably better to really avoid it. Probably,
I think so.
Probably better to even avoid many fruits and eat mostly vegetables.
Well, even the vegetables have it.
What but I you mean, want mostly
do,
vegetables.
What you actually want to do is consume more fat, more coconut oil, and use that as your primary fuel rather than sugar. So if you have less carbohydrate and more fat, only the cells that have mitochondria can burn the fat. The cancer cells' mitochondria don't work very well, and they're ill, and there's a defect in energy production there. And the cells become too acidic, and the cancer cells thrive in that environment. So if you don't feed them carbohydrate and you give them fat that's a healthy fat, such as the coconut oil, you may be able to put them into mild ketosis, which means the body is burning fat and making these ketone bodies.
Like the Atkins diet.
Yeah, a bit like the Atkins diet, maybe even a little bit more severe than that. To try and maintain a more normal biochemistry for normal cells, but a terrible environment for cancer cells.
Well, now something like the Gerson diet
It'd
for
totally
people
different.
With cancer
totally
is almost all vegetables.
Well, it's got a lot of carbohydrate in it, too.
Yeah, because it's got some apple in it and potato. People eat potato.
There are a lot of different ways to look at how a cancer cell works. And in the case of the Gerson protocol, what happened there was by trial and error, Max Gerson, 100 years ago, came up with this protocol that can help people who have cancer some of the time. But this other approach that we're talking about is another mechanism that is, from what I can tell, totally different from that. It doesn't make one right and the other wrong. They could both be right because they both seem to work.
Okay, what I'm just trying to find out is how far to carry the no sugar, just like not to eat refined sugars, to avoid fruits, to avoid starches.
The way you can tell, and most of the time you're going to have to avoid fruit, is whether or not your body goes into ketosis, meaning that it's primarily burning fat.
So do urine test. Use
you
that
do a urine
the
test.
pH strips.
Exactly. And if you're in a mild ketotic state, you're doing the best you can.
Is that acid or base?
It's neither that I know of. It would be a neutral diet.
So it's a different kind of strip than the pH strip.
Well, it's not a pH strip. It's looking at whether or not you have ketone bodies there.
But how do you know that? How do
because
you
the strip
that?
Tells you that.
Okay,
it's a chemical reaction that occurs in that strip. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on some of my favorite quotes. This ought to be special because you've got some amazing quotes. And when we come back, we're talking about, is there a new drug that can prevent Alzheimer's disease? Really? And we'll be talking also about when should blood pressure not be treated.
Some of my favorite quotes. Choose a job you love and you'll never have to work a day in your life.
Cool.
Be a good person, but don't waste time to prove it.
That's right. There are a lot of people that expect something.
When an unpleasant past calls you, let it be a missed call. Don't regret the past. Learn from it.
Mm.
Be with those who bring out the best in you, not the stress in you.
That's right.
Negative people need drama like oxygen. Stay positive and it will take their breath away. The worst distance between two people is misunderstanding.
Boy, isn't that common.
Trying to be happy by accumulating possessions is like trying to satisfy hunger by taping sandwiches all over your body. Isn't that a good one?
It really is. You know, it kind of reminds me of what's wrong with our culture. You know, we say money is evil, and of course, money's not.
It's
money's
the people.
Fine. It's the people, the way they use money. And it's the selfishness and the narcissistic approach to how they live their lives that makes things the way they are, which actually leads us to the next topic we're going to talk about that has to do with why you can't trust the FDA.
Well, a study out of Harvard confirms that what we've been saying all along about the FDA and the new drugs, because people tend to think if a new medicine comes out, it has to be better than the old one in
right,
its category.
Right, because it's new and improved, right?
But not so, no.
Definitely
because
not
90%
so.
Of all new drugs approved by the FDA over the past 30 years are little or no more effective for patients than existing drugs.
That's right.
Plus, medicines can be dangerous and even lethal. Mm-hmm. With 53,000 hospitalizations and 2,400 deaths per week.
Per week, that's right. And that's an understatement.
And this is from the expected side effects. Right. Just listen to the commercials.
That's right.
From properly prescribed medications. And if we add the misuse of meds, then the deaths total 400,000 per year.
And that's hard to believe, that something that is supposed to help people kills 400,000 people and puts millions in the hospital every year. And that's okay. It's sort of like looking at a war. You know, we're in the Iraq war. We lost about 8,000 people over 10 years. And here, over 10 years, we are losing 400,000 times, and 4 million people dying. Talk about a war that's
and
within our borders.
And nobody pays attention to it.
Well, it's like, well, that's the deal, and we must be saving more lives than we're killing. I'd like to see those studies, actually. I would love to see those studies. They don't exist. And who knows what it'll show.
So the other thing that they've found, that it's better to wait to take a medicine for at least 7 years after it. Its patent runs out. So let's talk about patents.
I think that's what experienced doctors do. They don't fall for this stuff that comes out. And that's why Marcia Angel, you know, the Harvard doctor that was the chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, quit her job and wrote a book talking about how corrupt the system is for the articles that are published in her journal, New England Journal of Medicine.
But see, so much of this has to do with money. And so when the patents run out, then they're not going to be able to make as much money on those drugs, because then it's like a free-for-all, because other groups can also make those medicines.
And then they can charge lower prices, and it has to be a competitive
right,
business.
Right, so they need to come up with a new medicine so they can charge more money again.
Well, you've got a good point there. That's attacking the system by looking at the end result of what happens. But we're not looking at the cause for what happens there. It's not that money is bad or that the businesses or the laws or the medicine or the science or the sport or any other aspect of our culture is the problem. That's not the problem. The problem is we need a social transformation where people are not narcissistic and self-serving, and they want to provide service rather than have a life that has a lot of material wealth in it, because the real value in life is the relationships that you have, and you need to build those in a way that supports things. And that's why we have problems like with the FDA and with drugs and with money and patents and all that business.
See, what they do, they're not honest, because what they're doing is they're trying to say that they want to encourage the fast track of these new medicines because we need these new medicines.
Oh, yeah, well, that's baloney advertising.
And then they're making up diseases, and they're exaggerating,
absolutely. They are making up diseases.
They're selling sicknesses and pre-diseases.
There's pre-hypertension. There's pre-diabetes. There's pre-obesity. There's pre-psychosis.
Osteopenia.
Yeah, I mean, all these things.
Alzheimer's.
These are not diseases at all. These are people that may be in a slightly higher risk for developing them, but there's no evidence showing that these are drugs that should be used to prevent the disease in a safe way.
Well, see, what people need to be aware of also is that Big Pharma makes money, makes monetary contributions to the FDA and Congress.
Oh, yeah.
And then they approve these new drugs without data proof of the benefit.
Yeah, well, that's right.
So they're really not safe. So they're mass marketing to exaggerate the benefits to get the new patented drugs out as the others lose their patents.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is how can we turn this system around?
Oh, well, that's straightforward, but nobody's looking at that. People are looking for, let's make some new laws. Let's make it illegal for them to do it. Let's penalize them if they try and corrupt Congress. Let's penalize them if they have unethical relationships with the FDA. That's not the answer. Laws don't work. Legislation doesn't work. Inspiration does. Social transformation. Right.
Ethics.
Back to where the problem is.
Ethics, morals.
Well, you need to learn those.
Conscience.
Well, you need to buy into that. And apparently, obviously, and clearly, we haven't bought into that. And that's why we have this conniving system where it's okay to do whatever you can in love and war and business. Well, hello. I mean, it's about trying to have a life that has meaning and value, that can support the development of community and make life something that we go through together to have a community.
Instead of peddling cures of questionable benefits and hidden risks of harm.
Oh, that's right.
The latest one is the one for preventing Alzheimer's.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's
another.
And where's
it published? The New England Journal of Medicine. How does it get into there? Ask Marcia Angel. She'll tell you. Because
well,
it's not unusual.
And the other one I want to just point out here is about chemotherapy, because this is where they really get people, because they'll say, well,
right.
The old chemo drug isn't working.
Yeah, so let's try the new one.
So let's try the new one.
Yeah,
you're
well,
really special. We're going to try this new drug on you.
Well, we have
instead,
to do something,
what they're
right?
Saying yeah. Is that we're making you a guinea pig.
Well, that's exactly what they're saying.
We're testing it on you.
And there's no real data behind doing it. You know, we talk about being scientifically based in medicine. We're evidence based. We do things out of science. Well, we don't really. What we get is desperate because we don't have solutions. The pharmaceutical industry comes into play by saying, well, we've got a new drug out, and the preliminary study suggests that there might be some value here. So let's do a clinical trial, okay, where we accept patients into it so they can do their study under the guise that they're helping people, when they're really doing is trying to do a clinical trial that is done in such a way that it has a good chance of showing that there's a benefit, even when there's not. And our literature is full of crap like that. And it misleads good doctors, and it misleads the public, and it gives the impression that the FDA is supporting us, when in fact they're corrupt in so many ways. If you want to learn about that, read my book, you know, A Return to Healing, A Return to Healing. It's about radical healthcare reform and the future of medicine. Read the chapter on the karma of Big Pharma, and it's got information in it that's based on literature that's from the major journals. So it's a sad scenario. That's all I can
also,
say.
Also, health guidelines often create controversy.
Oh, for sure.
Remember when the new guidelines for women to start mammograms came out?
Oh, yeah. Change
Talk
of,
about an uproar.
Well, everybody thought they were getting cheated from something that they deserved to be able to have. Yeah, right. They deserve to have it so that it can be done.
Increase the risk of breast cancer.
Well, it certainly is something that shouldn't be done on a regular basis. And there's a lot on our site that talks about that. You can go to drsabuto.com and put mammograms in the search box, and you'll get all kinds of information about that.
So anyway, now we have some new guidelines for hypertension, for high blood pressure.
Yeah, right.
Published in the January 2014 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Mm-hmm. So how do we know if these guidelines are correct?
Well, we don't. But I can tell you what you can garner from this. What they're saying is, we've assumed that the upper limit of blood pressure is 140 systolic and 90 diastolic. So if you're under that level, you're okay. But in fact, what happened in this particular
study
that the Joint National Commission that looks at this was looking for evidence-based guidelines for managing high blood pressure, and their conclusion was that for people over the age of 60, the blood pressure goal should be less than 150 over 90. Now, which one's right? You'd have to guess that because the number's higher, that the data that supports the lower number doesn't exist. And it was just assumed that that was an important thing, but it varies with different age. And we can look back.
Well, we know there's not really a lot of science in medicine.
Well, there's certainly no science in the stuff we're talking about, because otherwise, how does it change? It's not because we're doing better work as we are getting deeper into studies. It's because people are doing more studies that are designed to show things that are to their advantage. There's usually a conflict of interest because it's being paid for by some pharmaceutical industry or by some other organization that has something to gain from it. But well, here they're talking about loosening it. You know, the old data showed, or the old information that was proclaimed, was that you should have a blood pressure of 100 plus your age.
That's pretty high.
So if you were 20, it'd be 120 over 80. If you were 40, it'd be 140.
If you're 80, it'd be 180.
Yeah, right. And if you're 90, it'd be 190. Well, that was by proclamation. Somebody said that, put it in a textbook, everybody bought into it. Then some evidence or some studies were done that suggested that the blood pressure of 140 over 90 was the upper limit of normal, where you started to see increases in heart attacks and strokes and peripheral vascular disease, etc. And now, as they review all these studies, they're saying, no, it's more like 150 over 90 for older people.
If you're over 60.
If you're over
60. And 140 over 90 if you're under 60.
Right.
And those are the upper limits of normal. But
right.
Is 120 still considered the ideal blood pressure?
Well, I think it depends on who you are and what your setting is.
It's better to have it low than high anyway.
Well, I mean, you don't want a blood pressure of 220 over 110. I mean, that's obviously not a good blood pressure to have. But you don't want a blood pressure of 80 over 40 either, because you're going to get poor perfusion that way.
And that's what can happen when you take some of the medications.
Well, look at all the side effects.
They make people tired and faint, and they don't have enough energy. I was just talking to my dentist the other day. He told me his mother had high blood pressure, and the doctor put her on medication, and her blood pressure got so low that she was just so tired all the time and didn't want to get out of bed. And he says, oh, well, it's better than having high blood pressure. Then she fell.
Is it?
Then she fell and hit her head. Then another time she fell and broke her hip, and then she ended up dying from the complications of that.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, you don't want high blood pressure. It can lead to heart attack or a stroke or kidney failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could kill you.
Well, the medicines are problems, too. It's not like they're just innocuous and don't have side effects. They all do.
Yeah, besides making you tired and faint and lack of energy.
Well, they can do that. And what we need are studies that look at that as well as look at the benefits. We should be looking at the complications as well and presenting those in an honest and open way.
We need to manage our blood pressure without meds if we can, with a healthy lifestyle, and exercise is one of the best ways
as
far as
lifestyle. There's the DASH diet. There's exercise. There's sleep. If you don't get enough sleep, you're going to have high blood pressure.
You know, lowering your stress.
Stress does a lot. You're right. Your weight does.
And if you take a medication, it's probably better to choose a generic older drug than
absolutely
one of these newly patented ones we were just talking about.
And always take your blood pressure before you take your blood pressure pill, because your blood pressure will vary. Are you still going to take a blood pressure pill if your blood pressure drops to 100? And then maybe it'll drop to 80 or 70.
Then you wonder why you're passing out.
Exactly, or why you got that fractured hip.
Okay, then what do you think about pre-hypertension? Because that seems to be a new label.
Oh, well, that's another BS thing where somebody's assuming that you have a problem that's going to develop and become worse. It's like,
so if your blood pressure is 145 over 90 and instead of 150.
Do the things you can to improve your lifestyle, and you'll be way ahead of the game. It's a good place to start, and you need a good doctor for that. All right, we're at the end of the show, and we want to remind you that we're back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the DrSaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.